Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us. This is Adam Rosenzweig of Gehring & Rosenzweig Associates, along with Lee Gehring on the line as well. It is currently 2:45 p.m. on March the 9th, and we wanted to provide an update today, given everything that's been happening in the oil markets for the last week or so, and then really accelerating from last Friday until today. For a little bit of context, given the perceived impacts of the coronavirus to global oil demand, OPEC set a meeting for Friday, March the 6th, where they would be discussing cutting production by 1.5 million barrels a day, contingent on Russia going along with those cuts as well. By the end of the day on the 6th of March, it was becoming readily apparent that Russia would not be cooperating with those cuts, and those meetings ultimately ended with no cuts agreed to. This put at risk the existing cuts that OPEC Plus had put into effect several months ago, totaling about 2.1 million barrels a day. And indeed, the next day on Saturday, March the 7th, Saudi Arabia announced that they would be ramping up production, effectively eliminating those cuts as well, and effectively getting rid of their role as swing producer in the global oil markets. Oil markets on Monday the 9th responded very, very poorly. WTI prices are down 25% as we speak here at about $31.30 per barrel, making their two-day losses total approximately 35%. The same is true of Brent crude prices as well, making it effectively the worst two-day period since 1991. Oil stocks have been poor performers. They're down today approximately 24% as measured by the XOP E&P index, and some names at the worst are down nearly 65% on the day. So with that as a little bit of background and context, I thought it would make sense to go through where we see the fundamentals in the market today, what we believe is changing, and what we think the outlook is going forward. I thought the best way to go forward today would be to ask Lee a series of questions and sort of engage in a dialogue back and forth to help answer some of the most pertinent questions that I think are out there today. So with that, Lee, I'll kick it off. Obviously, investors are very, very worried today. The last time that you've had this amount of turmoil amongst the OPEC members was back in 2014 when Saudi Arabia also abandoned its role as swing producer, leading to a very weak period from 2014 to 2016. Do you think that we're about to enter into a similar period today?
Adam, that's a really good question. And hello, everyone. This is Lee Gehring, co-managing director of Gehring and Rosenzweig Associates. I believe that the underlying global fundamental standpoint regarding oil is vastly different than it was back in 2014. And the big difference between 2014 and 2020 today is the geological difference that's now gripping the U.S. shales. You know, if you go all the way back to 2014, one of the reasons why the Saudis waged a price war, there are a couple reasons, but one of the purported reasons was to basically kill the U.S. shale industry. 2014 was a huge year of oil shale growth in the United States. The oil shales grew by almost 2.7 million barrels a day back in 2014. And obviously, the Saudis said that they would like this growth to slow and the competition from the shales to cease. And what they did is they increased their production as well as all of OPEC, and oil spent the next 2 years falling from, you know, basically a peak of $105 in the second quarter of 2014 to $26 in the first quarter of 2016. And the big difference today is that if you go back to 2014, the drop in oil price eventually triggered a U.S. oil rig count that fell by 80%. And that U.S. rig count falling by 80% eventually caused the U.S. shales to slow and eventually to turn negative by a couple hundred thousand barrels a day. And from the fourth quarter of 2014, shale oil growth eventually fell by the first quarter of 2015 to being slightly negative. Now, what was so interesting then is you needed an 80% drop in the oil rig count for that slowing of the growth to occur. What's so different now, and we've written about this extensively, and I hope you people, our followers, are familiar with this concept of high grading. But because of the concept of high grading, combined with the fact that the amount of tier one, top tier acreage prospects in all the shale plays has dwindled dramatically, is that today you need a far smaller drop in the rig count to produce negative growth in the oil shales. And for example, the rig count in the oil shales now has been dropping over the last 12 months. We've dropped about 20% of the rigs drilling for shale. And already what's happened is that the shales have already turned negative with their supply growth. It's something that people don't talk about, but the latest EIA numbers that came out for U.S. shale production in December showed that month over month had finally turned negative. Now, it's interesting, back in the last cycle, you needed the rig count to fall by 80% to eventually get the shale production to turn negative. In this cycle, all you've needed is the rig count to fall by 20% to get the shale growth to be negative. And what's the reason for that? Well, it has to do with the idea of high grading. Back in 2014, which is now, it's almost 6 years ago, the lowest tier drilling rigs, the rigs that were drilling the lowest prospectivity wells in the shales, were almost 75% less productive than the rigs drilling top tier wells. So when you dropped one of those lower tiered rigs, the amount of associated oil production that was associated with it was very, very small. Today, because of high grading, because you're no longer drilling very unproductive and unprospective drilling prospects, the average lower tier rigs now are literally almost 60% as productive as a top tier rig. So now when you're dropping rigs, you are now dropping rigs that are very, very productive. Back in 2014, the E&P industry had the ability to drop rigs that were unproductive. That luxury no longer exists. So now a 20% drop in the rig count has already turned oil shale growth negative. And given the fact that companies have already announced that they're cutting drilling activity based upon what the Saudis did over the weekend, for example, Diamondback and big Permian producers announced both the dropping of rigs and the dropping of completion activity, that we believe that by the end of by mid 2020, that the oil growth out of the shales is going to turn quite negative by at least several hundred thousand barrels a day. In fact, it's almost guaranteed, we believe now, that 2020 growth in the shales will actually be flat year over year with 2019. And remember, this is down from original projections from a lot of oil analytic firms that the shales would grow between 1.2 to 1.7 million barrels per day. Obviously, we're going to have a huge miss regarding that. Why is this so important? Well, we have lost shale oil growth in the global oil balances. From a high of 1.7 million barrels a day estimated originally for 2020, it looks like it could very well come in at zero. So what that means is that we have a huge gap that has to be filled from the loss of growth out of the shales. Now, we don't know today what the demand impact from coronavirus is going to be. So far, we just have no handle on that, whether it's several hundred thousand barrels a day or a million barrels a day. We just don't know it as we go out through the year. But anyway, the competition from the shales and the knocking out of the shales out of global oil balances has already occurred.
Thanks, Lee. That's very, very interesting. And, again, just to put that in perspective, from 2014 in November, when Saudi Arabia decided to flood the world with oil, it took a full 12 months for the U.S. to see production actually roll over and be lower than that level. And here we are today going into these cuts, and shales are already declining on a month-on-month basis. So that could be really, really dramatic. One thing that we didn't talk about here briefly is the extent to which companies are beginning to run out of their best tier one acres. And I thought it'd be a little bit interesting as well to just sort of bring some statistics to the fore. Back in 2014 and 2015, if we look at approved, developed, producing barrels per debt-adjusted share of the E&P company universe, this is a equal dollar-weighted index, in 2015, that figure declined by about 7%, meaning that companies, given the low prices, were unable to grow their proved developed reserves per debt adjusted share in 2015. If we look at 2019, you know, keep in mind it was a relatively benign year for oil prices. They were averaged 55 for the year, but their proved developed producing reserves per debt adjusted share in the same universe actually declined by 20% last year. And we think that that's a fairly good proxy for understanding, you know, the extent to which these companies are running out of their tier one acreage. So here we are in a situation where production has already declined before this shock. Companies seem to have less readily available high quality drilling inventory. And so now that you've taken prices down with what happened over the weekend, we think the response to the shale from the shales could be very, very, very dramatic. So we spent a lot of time here talking about dynamics in the shales and how they'll likely respond. I was wondering, Lee, is there anything different about Saudi Arabia or Russia and the dynamics this time versus what occurred back in 2014?
Yeah, what's interesting is that it is very, very curious that the Saudis have decided to wage an all-out price war, given that they don't have the same level of fiscal ability to withstand it. For example, since 2014, when the end of 2014, when their foreign currency reserves peaked, they have fallen now over the last 5 years by 35%, and they will obviously go severely negative in the next year. The Saudis need an $80 to $85 oil price minimum for them to balance their budget. And now with oil prices in the low 30s, the Saudis are literally going to hemorrhage cash from here on out. Now, they had a much greater luxury to do that in back 2014 when they had a huge pile of foreign currency reserves. And like I said, that is almost 35 to 40% depleted today. So they just don't have that luxury. The other thing is that they don't have a lot of excess spare capacity to wage a price war. For example, because of the attacks, the Iranian-inspired drone attacks last year, it's still estimated that the Saudis have about 500,000 barrels a day of lost capacity from their damaged Abqaiq processing facility. So the idea, they said that they're going to take production up to 10.2 million barrels a day. They might be able to get oil production up that high. But the funny thing is they've also, you know, threatening to take it to 12 million barrels a day. We believe there's no way that they can actually take production anywhere much above 10.2 to 10.3. So the amount of oil that they can really use as a weapon is much less this cycle than it was back in 2014.
Fascinating. So basically, if we think about the global oil market today, we see a situation where in the short term, obviously concerns around this Saudi Arabia-Russia price war are weighing very, very heavily on the market. And the coronavirus sort of lingers in the background as people wait to see how demand numbers come in. But ultimately, to the extent that those issues can be resolved, even if it takes a period of time, the longer term dynamics here are the fact that you are basically eroding the U.S. shale industry, which now going back for the last 10 years has represented nearly 80% of all the global liquids growth in the world. And so, you know, the idea is that you've now coiled the spring even tighter, and to the extent that we had any sort of a normalization in demand or any sort of a resolution in any of these issues, you've now created potentially a very, very dangerous situation in global oil markets going forward. Just to finish off, Lee, are there any changes you would make to the portfolio as it stands today? Anything that you're thinking about in those terms?
No. Over the last couple of years, we've been very, very careful to construct a portfolio of E&P names that we believe have significant amounts of undrilled tier one acreage. And the reason why this is so important is that companies that are now running out of tier one acreage, which represent a huge portion of the operators in the shale, these companies are already starting to show significant bouts of production disappointments. For example, you know, a classic example of some of the big Bakken operators, which all reported disappointing production results in the fourth quarter. Our portfolio of E&P names, we believe, not only have the financial ability to withstand very, very low oil prices, in fact, the oil prices that we're seeing today, but we believe also have the ability to maintain their reserve base, even in these very, very low prices.
And I should point out that, you know, looking again at that analysis where I said earlier that in 2019, an equal-weighted index of E&P companies lost about 19% of their proved developed producing reserves per debt-adjusted share, our names, we estimate, accreted approximately 20% of produced proved developed producing reserves per debt adjusted share. So obviously, you know, we take a lot of time and effort trying to look for the names that have the highest quality acres. We think that that comes through in their ability to grow reserves on a debt adjusted share basis, and ultimately will mean that those names are better positioned to last through a period of distress like we could be seeing in global oil markets here. So with that, I want to thank everybody. If you have any questions, please don't hesitate to reach out. We're here and we're happy to answer any questions. And with that, thank you and good afternoon.